So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm Nate Larkin.
I'm David Hampton.
And we are here on a rainy Tennessee afternoon, late fall. The colors are bright. We're close to peak foliage, I think.
Yeah, wind is beginning to blow the leaves off all over everywhere.
Yeah. And I can already sense, you know, the onslaught of the full holiday season coming our way. Thanksgiving, well, Christmas.
Cracker Barrel has had their tree up since July.
And you know what? With the holidays coming, it's going to be more important than ever to keep a focus on positive sobriety.
It is. That's a trigger season for many, many people.
It really is. I'm about to head off this weekend to a men's weekend. The Samson Society is holding its annual retreat at a camp a couple hours west of Nashville. I'm really looking forward to that.
Right, right.
Yeah. And you'll spend some time with the grandson, I assume?
I am. I'm babysitting Sunday afternoon.
Are you?
For a while, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I'm sure it'll go fine.
Well, I have been looking forward to this episode. We'll introduce him in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back. Hang with us. We'll be back in a second here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And we are back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast with an old friend, a friend who's old?
Yeah, both are true. Both are true.
but a familiar face and a well-loved man here in the Nashville community, Al Andrews.
Good morning. It's great to be with you guys.
Oh, it's so good. For those of you who don't know Al, Al is the founder and executive director of Porter's Call, an amazing organization, ministry dedicated to the counsel and support of recording artists. Recording artists and not just musicians. Why do you say that, Al?
Well, you hate to make that distinction because a lot of these people live the same lives. They're on the same bus.
Yeah.
But they're just three of us, and so we have to have a fence.
Yeah.
And the industry supports us.
Oh, I see.
Generously. And it makes sense that a record company would support something that helps their artists.
Sure.
And so we see signed artists or indie artists who tour their own music.
I see.
People in their bands. We have a great list of referrals for them. So we can't see them, but we can send them elsewhere, and they can get help and get it paid for usually. So.
Well, I do know from conversations I've had with artists, many of whom live very carefully hidden, sheltered, and often lonely lives.
Yeah.
What a huge and saving influence you and the other people at Porter's Call have been in their lives.
Thank you. It's a real privilege for us. We really love to be a safe place for them to come.
Yeah. David, you've known Al for even longer than I have.
Yeah, we go back further than we probably either one want to admit.
No. That might make you an old man, too.
No, I think we were 11 when we met or something like that.
Oh, gosh.
But, yeah, we go way, way back into the early, what I call the early Nashville days for me, the early 90s and things like that.
Yeah.
And Al, and his wife Nita, who's also mm-hmm. been a guest yes. on Positive Sobriety podcast, were doing counseling work at a church we both attended at the time. In Franklin, and we just got to be friends and got to know one another. And as Al embarked on this real passion for the creative community, then our paths began to continue to cross just because of the nature of me doing music at the time and mm-hmm. things like that, and having a lot of artist friends in common. In this present season of my life, now that I've been doing recovery work full time, Al and I crossed paths a lot again because, as you can imagine, there might be people in the entertainment community that would be dealing with addiction.
No.
a couple.
It turns out. From time to time.
Occasionally, yes. Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
And so we've been kind of good to bounce things back and forth and see how we can partner together with helping some folks. And in that way, too, as Al and I were talking about him being a guest mm-hmm. here, he began to share some things with me about the way he walks with artists, about things that he encourages artists in. And we began to see a lot of parallels between people who may be active in their addiction or new into recovery and some of the uniquenesses that artists believe about themselves. And so maybe let Al tell us a little bit about how that looks.
Yeah, recovery is a new way of life, and it requires a reorientation of our thinking. We have to recalibrate how we see the world and how we see ourselves. And so I guess yes. that's a big part of what you do, at least in the initial stages, Al.
It really is. It really is. And one of the things that over the years I've seen is that everybody doesn't have to become an addict,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so a friend of mine came up with a word. We were working with a group of young artists who were just kind of starting out.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, let's call it prehab.
Ooh, nice.
That's great.
I wish I could say that I had that. That was a friend from on-site. But so we're thinking, what would a life look like if you could steer around?
Yes.
If you didn't have to get sucked into the life of addiction. And what would life look like if you're in recovery? Because both of those would look pretty much the same.
Yeah, what if you could live a sober life without going into the ditch first?
Yes. And,
okay.
And not a lot of people can do that, I think, but we can try.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so that's a lot. So if a young artist comes in, my favorite thing is an artist comes in without a big issue. He just
right.
says, hey, somebody told me this is a good place to come, so I'm here.
Right.
And if that's the case, we say, well, let's dig into things that might be a problem for you based
yeah.
on your story that you don't know yet, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And see if we can steer around them and shore you up. Let's think about living a life of sobriety before you
yeah.
get drunk.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, or
before you hit
whatever.
The wall. Yeah.
Whatever
yeah, yeah.
wall you hit. Yeah. And you know, we'll see how that works, but either way, it's the same thing for somebody after they've hit the wall or before they hit the wall.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, what does it mean to live a healthy, sober life?
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess over time, these conversations have distilled into principles that
mm-hmm.
you can now
yeah.
articulate, go through. Can you give us a few of those?
Well, it's interesting. Somebody asked me, I think it was a record company one time, said, will you come and talk to our people about what we can do or how we can encourage our artists
mm-hmm.
to live healthy lives?
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa. So I just sat down one day and just kind of wrote, okay, if I was giving somebody advice on here are some things
yeah.
that, some practices, if you will, that will help you live well in this crazy industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll just go through a few of them, and then we
yeah.
can, y'all have the whole list, and we can talk about them. One is know the why. Why are you doing this? Be wary of fame. Be known by someone. Resist comparisons.
Holy smokes. Okay.
Bridge the distance, which is the distance between how you're perceived and what you know about yourself.
I see.
You know, and so there's about 20 of those. And you have the list, and if there's some you want to ask me about, but that's the kind of thing is do that.
Yeah. Well, I love the first one, know the why, you know, the why behind the what, you know, why you're doing what you're doing and why every day this drives you. And
what is a healthy why and what is an unhealthy why, Al?
Well, one thing I want to say in the beginning of this is where I wrote this for artists. It's really, with the exception of a few things, it's really for me.
Right.
You know, it's really for you.
Yeah.
And so you can replace the word artist with whatever you do for a living or just your name.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think for an artist, if I say know the why, I'm saying that because sometimes the why is because I want to be famous and I want to be rich and I want to have a big house and I want to have a room full of shoes like they do in that program, or I want to have six cars in the garage.
Right, right, right.
And I'll challenge that if that's the why.
Yes.
Because that's going to get them nowhere. But the why for an artist, why are you doing this? Let's say you have the stage.
Yes.
A big stage. What's it for?
And
so I think, and in that mean, I mean, you have a chance to change the world here.
Sure.
You have a chance to build thousands of wells like some people are doing and giving people water, saving lives. But I think for anybody who wakes up in the morning, why are you getting up?
Yeah.
What is the purpose of your getting up? And it doesn't have to be filling stadiums. It may be that I am going to do something today to be kind to this world.
Yeah.
Because if there's something this world needs right now, it's kindness. But to me, even that would be a good why.
Yeah.
I'm going to be kind, or I'm going to try to be selfless at least for 10 minutes today or something like that.
Yeah.
But you probably have more.
But if the why is all about me,
right,
that's a dead end.
It's a dead end. And that never ends well. And that's just not worth getting up for.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. Even perhaps the idea of staying sober so that I can have a better life is not a good enough why.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Al, it seems like, you know, I know that you are an excellent communicator. You're a great storyteller, writer, communicator. Do you help artists begin to think of themselves differently rather than just entertainers, but as communicators about what it is they want to leave the world? Am I hearing you say what they want to leave the world with?
Yes. In fact, to me, that's the most fun part of our work at Porter's Call. Is not just helping artists to be better or be better, you know, helping their careers to grow and whatever. I'm glad if they do. But really getting them to go, there's a larger purpose in my life.
Yeah.
If, you know, and singing may be a route to that purpose, but, you know, I'd love to help people try to articulate what I can do with this.
Yes.
Because I think that gives them a reason to get up. That's a reason to keep moving, because something's going to change. Something can change for the good.
Yeah.
I know a guy who's creating little scholarships for kids in his tiny hometown in Mississippi to go to school, to go to college for the first time in their family, or to go to music school.
Yeah.
And he's helping to raise money to give them music lessons while they're in high school, and then scholarships for college.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's really changed his attitude toward music because I'm doing something.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Another one of your principles that really stuck out to me, Al, was resist comparisons.
Yes.
Talk to us about the danger of comparison.
Well, you know, somebody said, usually when you say that, they go St. Augustine or they make up a name. C.S. Lewis. Yeah. Somebody said.
It's always C.S. Lewis.
It's always C.S. Lewis. It's a fallback. C.S. Lewis said.
Or Mark Twain. Or
Mark Twain. Is comparison is the thief of joy.
Yeah.
And I really believe that to be true because comparison, it just never ends.
Yes.
Yeah.
It just never ends. You can, because the person sitting beside you is going to have more clients, is going to have more people at their concerts, is going to sell more books, is going to have more people listening to their podcasts, whatever.
Yeah.
And it just turns you into this anxious person who is never satisfied.
Right, right.
You know, having worked with a lot of artists, I know a lot, have a lot of friends who moved to town at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe say six people moved to town at the same time doing music.
Right.
And you can see it happen all the time. All of a sudden, one of their stars begins to rise.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the other people have to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And if they're bent on comparison, they're depressed and they feel like failures.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If they're learning to be content, which is the issue, in where they are, they can rejoice for their friend. I'm not going to say it doesn't hurt and doesn't sting, because of course it does. You know?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if they do comparison, they're just going to feel like losers.
Right.
And I don't know really how to tell somebody to resist comparison. I just want to put it out there.
Right.
To say, when you do it, it is destructive.
Yeah.
Well, and can that be, maybe that can kind of go back to your know the why?
Yes.
Because your why may be different than the person whose star is rising. Not that their why isn't valid too, but your message may be uniquely aimed at a very specific audience that isn't going to support 5 million records sold or whatever the best case scenario is nowadays, and being in a social media driven culture now, comparative thinking is, I mean, we all think that everybody's family looks good in the beach pictures, and
if you think about it, there's like 12 things that I could focus on today that have to do with comparison. For instance, I saw you drive up, your car is nicer than mine. Not that I noticed. But
I live in it, though. That's what you
know. But actually, that's okay with me today.
Mm-hmm.
But there may have been a time, or there may come a time, where I'll go, oh, I really want that car, and I'm so bummed that I don't have it.
Yes.
Or it can go throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a nonprofit. Another friend in a nonprofit just got a big gift. I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you guys, somebody's probably doing a podcast on addictions across town.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have a million listeners.
Mm-hmm.
So what?
Right.
But it's I think it's something just to be aware of, that it will never work.
Yes.
And it's never good for you.
Yeah.
And see if you can catch yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that I don't have to notice those around me. I notice this a lot. I'm a writer, and I notice this when I read. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll pick up a book, and it's won a Pulitzer, and I'm reading it, and this person writes like a god.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's, and I find myself getting depressed.
Right.
Going, oh, I can never write that well. Why do I even bother?
And that's a great example of the offspring of comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really think about it, you go, yeah, they're a great writer.
And I imagine on the flip side, if you do manage to make it to the top of the mountain or close to the top of the mountain, and according to one metric or another, you're ahead of your peers, there's some danger there, isn't there?
Oh, there is. And yet, even there, comparison doesn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I fill up an arena,
mm-hmm.
somebody else filled it up two nights in a row.
Right, right. Yeah, mm-hmm. right, yeah. Exactly.
And you go, that's nuts, but that's true.
Yes.
Or, you know, if I sell 1 million books, they sold 2 million.
Right.
So it never stops.
Mm-hmm.
But so the danger is if you rise up,
yeah.
the danger is really believing that the issue will stop.
Sure.
Because mm-hmm. it doesn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Al, how do you guys at Porter's Call encourage an artist who, when they're not with you at Porter's Call, in probably their machine, what we might call their machine here in Nashville,
mm-hmm.
Is encouraging them that they are terribly unique, they are above and beyond deserving of X, Y, and Z. You should definitely have this. Don't go in there until they do that. And yet your principles that you're working with them are kind of like saying, share the stage, bridge the distance, be known, and we were talking a little bit about the fact that there's a humility that you're mm-hmm. beginning to have to relearn as yeah. a person that's been
yeah.
trained for that.
Well, that's an interesting question. One of the principles that I completely stole from Thistle Farms,
mm-hmm.
they have principles to live by, is walk behind.
Mm.
And the person that you describe, there's not a lot of those who have that in town. I mean, there's 80% are not having the bus and
right.
all
yeah,
that kind
right.
of stuff. But for those who do have that, one of my challenges is, for instance, probably 70% of the time that I want to go to a concert at the Ryman,
mm-hmm.
by the time I punch the little button to get tickets, it's sold out.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And I live with the disappointment that I can't go.
Right.
If a star, and I don't know her, but let's say if Taylor Swift called up an hour before the concert,
mm-hmm.
she would have a seat in the front row balcony at the Ryman.
Yes.
And to people who have, the people at a certain level
mm-hmm.
always have seats.
Mm-hmm.
You see them at NBA games, they're always down the front.
Right.
You see them at ball games, they're always on the front row. They're always...
Sure.
People don't say no.
Right.
And so my encouragement is to them, I want there to be times where you give up the privilege that's offered to you.
Mm. Mm.
Walk behind. Mm-hmm. You're always pushed to the front of the line.
Yes.
Stay in the back of the line one time. Wait for tickets. Maybe one time, don't ask for special favors.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go to the concert if it's sold out.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to go to that restaurant and they're booked,
don't go.
Don't go.
Yeah.
Mm.
Call Thursday.
Go Thursday. Or go at 3:30 like the old people like me. No.
The oily void.
Yeah.
Go to Golden Corral.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, we'll have to cut that.
Yeah, we'll have to drop that.
Drop that name. But does that make sense? To can I say, don't take all the privileges that are offered to you.
Right.
Or maybe give them to somebody else.
Well, Bill Wilson wrote in the 12 and 12, the 12 steps and 12 mm-hmm. traditions of AA in chapter 7, that humility really underlies all the steps.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. I was, I heard an artist, wonderful artist, say to a group of young artists one time, my mantra is be gracious on the way up and gracious on the way down.
Mm. Mm.
And that was followed by, if you don't believe that the person that's checking coats in at the Coliseum is infinitely more interesting than you, then you have a problem.
Wow.
Boom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And basically the word was, if you go up in this industry, you're going to come down.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a few people don't. Bono doesn't. Mick Jagger doesn't. They just keep going up, whatever.
Yeah.
But most people peak, and that's okay.
They're all over town.
That's okay. That's life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Funny sidebar, just when I was a staff writer at the first publishing deal I had when I first moved to town, we had interns, you know, constantly, and they were in charge of, you know, basically coffee, cleaning up, doing whatever people needed to do, helping the writers get a room and things like that, a writing room, that is.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, they were often really just kind of like, you know, dismissed. They were those serfs, you know, of the system. Mm-hmm. And what was funny was I went in one day and this person that had been the intern, coffee and this kitchen guy, was the new tune plugger. And that he is the guy who's pitching all our music.
That's great.
And so suddenly, you know, he was so endearing, and we were
it became very fascinating.
Yeah, completely wondered about his family and his life and how his grandma was. And,
that's a good lesson.
You know, but yeah, you just don't know. So
So back to your word, humility is the base.
Yeah.
The baseline is staying there. Because that's where you find truth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you address uniqueness?
Say a little more.
Well, uniqueness can be actually, you know, it's what brings you to the party because you're, you know, music is unique in a certain way and all of that. But as a belief about myself, you know, in recovery, we talk about terminal uniqueness, which means that everything that worked for everybody else won't work for me because I'm so special and my pain is so special and specific that you don't understand me. So I appreciate the 12 steps. I appreciate being mentored and having a sponsor and getting, you know, into treatment. But
and if I were an ordinary mortal, that might apply to me, but I am a special case.
Yeah.
And in terms of uniqueness, what's the other word you use? Maybe a special case. I'm different from everybody else.
Yeah.
I think I address it by not treating them differently. If you fill a stadium if you can't fill the Bluebird, to me, you're the same. And I think that's what that's important for us because you have the ability to speak into someone's life if you don't care about their uniqueness or their status, but you care about their hearts. And so I think we address it by not treating people differently, and we address it by not charging. So if somebody comes in and makes $20 million a year, we don't charge them. And I actually had somebody say to me one time, "How much is this?" I go, "It's free." No, how much is it?" "It's free." And the word was, "Everybody makes money from me." I said, "Well, I don't."
Yeah.
And I don't need your tickets. I don't need
a
CD. And you can't fire me. I mean, you can stop coming, but, you know. You know, and that helps with, we're all level here. And if I see someone that is acting arrogant, I'll address it because it's just wrong, you know,
and
it's just helpful to level the playing field for everybody. And I love what you said about going to a group. We're all kind of the same.
There's another of your principles that I'd like to ask you about. I do know that, you know, at the heart of addiction, really, at least in my experience, is mood modification. I don't want to feel bad, and I find a way to escape negative feelings and to feel good. And over time, it takes more and more of that substance or activity in order to achieve the same level of good feeling. And before I know it, I'm deep in a pit somewhere. I remember a sponsor telling me early on that I had a lot of grief work to do.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, to be perfectly honest, I mean, I don't love sorrow. And I still have, I think, a fair amount of grief work that's undone.
Mm-hmm.
You advise the men and women that you work with to embrace sorrow.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that.
I am so glad you asked me about that one. It's so interesting. Probably within the first two times that I see someone, the subject of sorrow will come up.
Mm.
Years ago, I taught a psychology class, and it was on psychopathology, which is sounds really fancy.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's what's wrong with people. So one we would talk about eating disorders, one week we'd be talking about depression, one week mm-hmm. addictions, mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I started each class with this quote. And I don't think I stole it. I think I made this one up.
I'll steal it.
Okay. But it probably came from C.S. Lewis. The flight from sorrow leads to the loss of hope.
Wow.
I'll say it again. The flight, fleeing from sorrow, mm-hmm. leads to the loss of hope. And as I look at each of the things that I taught about each week,
mm-hmm.
the denial of sorrow mm-hmm. is a part of them all,
mm-hmm.
often.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's chemical,
mm-hmm.
there's something, and I'm depressed, there's some sorrow that I've not faced.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Someone has an eating disorder. There isn't a relationship that they've not faced that there's deep sorrow with.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. On and on and on. And I am going to find a way to comfort myself.
Yes.
As you said, mm-hmm. because I hurt. It's funny. One of the things that I ask people is when you were growing up,
mm-hmm.
You learn, your parents teach you things by how they act.
Sure.
And I ask people, how did you learn how to do sad?
Yeah.
Mm.
And in my home growing up, my parents both had, my father was 19 years old when he landed on Omaha Beach.
Wow.
And went through the war as a machine gunner.
Mm-hmm.
And lost friends and killed people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he did not want any more sadness.
Yes.
And so it was an unwritten rule in my home
mm-hmm.
that we're going to be happy.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so if I go, I'm really sad that my hamster died, I'll get another one that afternoon.
Right, right, right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, or somebody will break out into the sun will come up tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like that. It was so much. And it took me about 32 years to sink into a dark depression.
Mm-hmm.
But because finally my soul said, there is no more room in here.
Yeah.
There's no more room in here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ask people that, and you won't believe that, well, you would, the different answers. I'll say, how do they teach you? Well, people have it worse than you.
Yeah.
Boys don't cry.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Girls don't cry. Tough it up. Man, and on and on. Mm-hmm.
Christians don't cry.
Mm-hmm. What was yours?
God's in control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but which pissed me off at God.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
If he's in control, why am I so sad?
That's right.
Yeah, but it's so interesting. I've asked a group of 500 people this question and just said, well, a few people just stand up and tell me what you've learned. And maybe 20 people will stand up and go and give me a statement like you gave me.
Yeah.
And I've met no one that's family said something to the effect of embrace sorrow.
Yes. Mm.
Let it in. Actually, our family does now. Mm-hmm. When my boys were growing up, we're going to do sorrow.
Yeah.
We're gonna do it, and they do, and we do.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I had a counselor one time, and this was after I'd been counseling for years, and I had told him my story, and I thought I'm done with this thing. You know, I got this mm-hmm. down. I cry and stuff like that. And he said, "Al, are there any songs that make you cry? And I went, yeah, there are three. And he said, what? And I said, well, Fanfare for the Common Man by, I'll think of it in a minute. Take It With Me by Tom Waits, and Chris Rice, Untitled Hymn. Mm. Mm-hmm. He said, so I have an assignment for you. I want you to go home or go to your office really early in the morning, lay down on the floor, put the headphones on, and put those songs on. And when you feel a tear come to your eye, open your mouth and let it rip.
Wow.
Like a three-year-old.
Wow.
And I thought that was kind of weird. But I did it, and I went early enough so that nobody else was going to walk into the office. And I put that on. I put those three songs on, and I just laid on the carpet, and a tear started coming into my eye, and I started wailing. And he said, cry like a three-year-old. Let mm-hmm. it out. Don't whimper like an adult.
Yeah.
And I just started wailing, and I to this day I don't know why. Mm-hmm. But my assumption is that there is a stream of sorrow that runs through all of us all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because frankly, we're just living in a world that's not our home. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're homesick and we're sad. And if I look at the news every day and I hear, this morning I was listening to NPR and they were telling these stories of injustice, and I just heard four of them and I went, I need a break.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's good or bad, but there's so much sorrow in this. And I actually do that little practice about every 6 months.
Do you?
Just because the reality of embrace sorrow is just true all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, if I knew the button to push in you right now, and mm-hmm. you knew the button to push in me right now, we'd be sobbing on the floor.
Yes.
If mm-hmm. you knew the right question to ask.
Yes.
And so to me, I think the more we embrace it,
yeah,
the less we need something to comfort us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Long answer to your question.
That's a great answer.
And what surprises me is the very thin membrane between sorrow and joy.
That's a great point. I'd love to hear more.
But I experienced it on Sunday morning. It was I was raised Pentecostal and a very demonstrative worship style, mm-hmm. and experienced a lot of spiritual wounding during those years, which turned me angry and cynical, and all that scabbed over, and I became a Presbyterian.
But that could be like on a poster. Anyway,
but last Sunday I was in a worship service, and the pastor taught on the Hebrew words for praise. It turned some lights on that I hadn't seen before, and then Chris, big worship artist, Chris Tomlin was leading worship, and he did Andrew Peterson's call and response song from the Lamb of God, Is He Worthy?
Oh, my gosh.
And all of a sudden, I was freaking Pentecostal again, practically levitating there in the service. And it calls for the response. You're supposed to sing back, Is He Worthy? And the answer is, He is, right? And I start to say, He is. I start to sing, He is. And it's like this sob comes from someplace deep, right?
Yeah.
And then it turns to laughter.
Wow.
And I was experiencing this sadness and this joy all at the same time. Mm. I mean, I buttoned it down real fast and walked out, but
sure.
Yeah. But they are related. They are very close, aren't they?
I think they are. I was telling someone one day, I said, I feel like we ought to, in some ways, when it comes to laughter and sorrow, be like three-year-olds. Mm-hmm. Three-year-olds cry about 10 times a day, and they laugh as much.
Uh-huh.
You know, they'll can I have a cookie? No.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And then a few minutes later, they'll be laughing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But and there's this fence that we're on the top of, and we can go both ways
pretty quickly. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a great example of it, that they are connected. And I would say there's something about that moment for you that sorrow that's in that stream was tapped into and released. And at the same time, I don't know, it'd be great to explore one time the connection between that and joy. But I think it may be the relief and the, you know, and it may be the fact that a lot of times people will ask me, why are you making me do this? Mm-hmm. Why are you making me think of those sad things?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I hate to say this, but 'cause Jesus tells you to. and the reason I hate to say this is because it sounds like something I wouldn't want somebody to say to me.
Yeah, but
I said, blessed are those who weep.
Yeah.
Why? For they will be comforted.
Yeah.
And my assumption is that the opposite is true.
Yeah.
And those who don't will not.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it feels to me like, you know, they will be comforted could maybe be translated, they will be known.
Yes.
You know, because that's, I had an experience, it's funny, we were talking about this, because I was in my car and had a random Pandora station on, you know, where it just plays random stuff. And John Ondrasik's The Five for Fighting Superman song came on, you know. I'm not made to fly. I'm not that naive, you know. I'm just a man in a silly red sheet. And that song makes me cry because I feel known, because somebody articulated that whole persona thing in a way that I could have never thought to creatively put that together. Mm-hmm. And when he sings that, it is like, damn, that's me.
Yeah.
And I feel known. And I feel like there's an empathetic witness, you know, to my pain.
Yeah.
And so that that joy is that it kills me because the persona nearly did.
Yeah.
And but the joy is that I feel known in someone singing that.
Interesting.
To me, about me.
Yes.
In that way.
Yeah. And I wonder in both of the cases of you in church and you listening to that song, if blessed are those who mourn for they will be comforted, takes place in that moment.
Yeah.
In other words, you weep when you hear that song and when you start to sing it. And because you weep, you're comforted.
Yes.
And there comes the joy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did we just discover something here?
I don't know. Maybe. I think in our unwillingness to cry inhibits our ability to experience joy, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I feel like it's the basis of a lot of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And one of the saddest things is whether it's an artist or someone coming in my office in addiction, is that if I believe that I can't be known, then that to me is so paralyzing, sad, and dooming, you know.
Yeah, and I'm wondering whether for the artist there might be a special hazard here. You know, there's a difference between crying and being sad and telling a sob story.
Mm-hmm.
I have found that it's very tempting to me to get other people to feel the pain of my story.
Hmm.
If I can get you to cry for me, then I don't have to cry. I can tell the story in a dispassionate way, but I don't have to actually enter into it.
Exactly.
I can move you, and I don't have to move.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if I'm a good artist,
mm-hmm.
I can manipulate you emotionally. I can really put you on a ride and never leave the ground myself.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think that can be true.
Yeah.
And a good challenge to think about when you release that story.
Mm-hmm.
Where the context of giving away your sorrow, mm-hmm. Or revealing it to others.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. One more thing you had, Al, before we have to wrap up, I wanted you to get a minute to talk about is you one of your principles is you say don't keep secrets.
Yeah.
You know, in recovery, we are always saying we're as sick as our secrets, and
yeah.
we're only as sick as our secrets.
Mm-hmm.
How do you encourage people who, you know, people make money off of their secrets when they're found? Mm-hmm. How do you
right.
Encourage them to feel safe in that?
You know, it's really hard, and I would say it's probably hard for everybody, but when you get in the public eye, it's even harder because often if your secrets are revealed in some circles, it's over.
Right, mm-hmm. Sure.
And sometimes in some circles, if your secrets are revealed, your stock goes up. But it just depends on which genre you're in.
Yeah.
But one, I stress the importance of it that you don't have to go on stage and tell everybody your secrets.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody needs to know.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody needs to know because, frankly, in addition to a lot of other things, you need to see that there's mercy and grace in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And so be careful who you tell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. tell a trustworthy person. But you both know what it's like when somebody tells you your secret and you don't flinch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And you probably even say, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And yeah. they're so shocked that
yeah.
you don't leave.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
that's their expectation.
Sure.
And maybe their experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to me, I think the first step is find somebody, and it can be me,
mm-hmm.
you know, today, but find somebody in your world that knows, mm-hmm. so they can be with you, so they can lock arms with you,
yeah.
and be a part of it, and so you can experience grace,
because
mm-hmm. that's huge,
mm-hmm.
to be known and still loved.
Yeah,
mm.
yeah.
And I think, you know, if you have an upfront profession, whether that's speaking, singing, acting, whatever, people create a certain persona that they believe
mm-hmm.
about you.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, if I preach at a church and I do well and I'm at my best, people think that's who I am.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm.
And then but that's why it's always good to have my wife sitting on the second row. Because Nita knows who I am and still loves me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm tempted to believe what everybody else believes.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. He's an amazing person, whatever.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And so the more you're up front, the more someone needs to know you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I now and then I'll get a small group of artists together so they can know each other.
Oh, that's mm-hmm.
nice. And really know each other.
Yeah.
And I would do that in any profession, any group. Somebody needs to know you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Al, I just cannot thank you enough for taking some time for your schedule to visit with us.
Oh, it's been a privilege. I wish we could stay longer.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, we'll have you back.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. And in the meantime, I hope you'll get hard at work on the book that includes all of these
thank
principles.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I've been encouraged to do that, so maybe that'll push me over the edge to
yeah.
get started.
Well, like I said, I think it's applicable in so many walks of life. This is just sort of, you know.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't identify with it at all, but it was great to talk about it.
Well, it's always nice to talk about
purely theoretical terms.
Maybe it'll help somebody out there.
All right. Well, just stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I love that guy.
I do too. That man has been a part of my story in Nashville for a long time.
You know, I was talking about him with a friend this morning. I go walking with a different guy every morning.
Mm.
And he described Al the way a lot of people describe Al, the man with the perpetual smile. He is just kind of a comfy, jovial presence. And you wouldn't know, most people wouldn't suspect until you talk to him for a while that
mm-hmm.
that he has experienced depression. He's gone through the darkness.
Right.
And he has learned that connection between sorrow and joy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when we were really just kicking around having him here, and mm-hmm. he said, well, I don't know what I would talk about. And then after being in today's episode, I was like, what in the world do you mean? You don't know what you would talk about. You know, I'm gonna be chewing on this list for a month.
Yeah, yeah. So. I do hope that Al takes the entire list, and we didn't read them all
for
our listeners, and writes a few pages on each. I think it'd be a very valuable guidebook.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have another guest coming up next week.
We do.
Yeah.
And we're excited, as always.
As always. Well, until next week, then, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
We're your pals here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.